This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Liz Murray's parents were drug addicts. Growing up in the Bronx in the 1980s and 90s, Murray had to fend for herself. When she got lice, she was on her own. Murray regularly went days without food. Once, she and her sister were so hungry, they shared a tube of toothpaste and chapstick. At the age of 15, she moved out, spending her teenage years homeless on the streets, largely skipping school. A tragic ending is what you might expect next. Instead, last year, Liz Murray graduated from Harvard University. Murray tells her heartbreaking and inspiring story in her new memoir, Breaking Night, and she joins us now from our New York Bureau. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you were here in the studio, I think I'd have to come give you a big hug.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm so excited to be here.
The book is beautifully written, and it's so hard to read. And I don't know if this makes your story harder or easier to absorb, but it's you make it so clear that, in fact, your parents, neglectful though they were, really loved you.
Very much so. And, you know, I didn't even know that that was something people would take note of or that it should be different or was a big deal. I happened to share that matter-of-factly with folks and was surprised to learn how shocking that was to others. Yeah, I mean, my parents were addicted to drugs, hardcore drugs, and they were not without their faults, believe me. But at the same time, they were incredibly loving people, and I grew up getting that message one way or another throughout my entire life with them.
And yet they were so utterly unable to care for you.
Well, yeah, Mom was schizophrenic and legally blind, and Dad had OCD. You know, he was mentally ill, and they were both addicted to cocaine and heroin. I got the hunch growing up they were probably not running off to be better parents to some other kids and coming back at night to spite me and my sister. You know, it wasn't, you know, people can't give you what they don't have. And that's what they've really taught me. And the blame piece really never came up for me. If anything, I more got the message that, okay, Liz, you're going to have to figure out some stuff on your own in life.
Mm. Can I ask you to read an excerpt just to give people
sure.
a flavor of life in that apartment in the Bronx, you, your sister, and your parents? There's a segment there, page 13, starting with how you learned that Ma and Daddy...
Sure. Yeah, I have it here. Okay. Sure. I learned that Ma and Daddy shared strange habits together. And this is when my father came home from prison, and I'm about 3-4 years old, the full details of which were hidden from me. Ritualistically, they would spread spoons and other objects along the kitchen table in some kind of urgent preparation. Over the display, they communicated in quick, brief commands to each other. Water was needed, a small amount from the faucet, and so were shoelaces and belts. I was not supposed to bother them, but observing their busy hands from a distance was allowed. From the doorway, I often watched, trying to understand the meaning behind their activity. But each time Ma and Daddy were done setting the strange objects across the table, at the very last minute, one of them would close the kitchen door, blocking my view entirely. This all remained a mystery until one summer evening when I parked myself in my stroller, which I used until it gave under my weight, in front of the kitchen. When the door was closed to me again, I did not budge from where I sat but remained, and I waited. I watched roaches weaving their way in and out of the door crack, a recent addition to the apartment since Ma stopped cleaning. While each minute dragged by, Ma finally emerged. Her face was tense, her lips pursed together. Sensing that something that they had finished, I said something that would be retold to me in story form for years. I raised my arms in the air and gave a sing-song, "All done." Taken off guard, Ma paused, leaned in, and asked disbelievingly, "What did you say, Pumpkin?" "All done," I repeated, delighted at Ma's sudden interest. She yelled for Daddy, "Peter, she knows. Look at her, she understands." He laughed a light laugh and went about his business. But Ma remained there at my side, stroking my hair. "Pumpkin, what do you know?" Thrilled to have found my place in their game, I made a habit of seating myself in front of the kitchen each time they retreated inside. Eventually, they left the door open.
So you spent years watching your parents shooting up. At what point do you remember, did you understand what they were doing?
You know, they had always... Mom and Dad lived this heyday in the 70s in New York City. They were hippies. They were disco dancing. They lived this high life. And my sister and I grew up in the aftermath of what happened when the party was over. And I think it was just always a part of the dialogue in our home. Drugs. They'd gotten high in the 70s. They were getting high at that time. What we didn't know, and which came as much more of a surprise, is the impact that that would create on our lives. We were living for the day, only the moment. And we had no idea what was coming and that our family would unravel. That was more the surprise.
But I mean, a 3-, 4-, 5-year-old doesn't know, you know, what happens when mommy shoots the needle in her arm. When did you figure that out?
I knew that they went in, put needles in their arms, and came out different. Their eyes would be flung wide open. It was like electricity was surging through them. They'd pace the apartment frantic. And then inevitably the drugs would wear off and they would crash. And then they would go into their suffering, withdrawal, and the process would repeat itself. That was obvious. I didn't know what other people out in the world would think of me knowing that. I didn't know what that meant or the significance, but I certainly knew mom and daddy were doing something.
You know, beyond the hunger and the poverty, it is this severe neglect that comes through most clearly to me and your desperation for some attention. It seems like you and your sister reacted, though, differently to how your parents were treating you.
Yeah. You know, Lisa, she's my older sister, and she had a lot of anger at what they were doing. And you know what? That's okay. Rightfully so for her, and I honor that. That was her experience. For me, though, I would look at my mother and my father, and they seemed so broken. There were so many things about them that were hurting, and anger was not a piece for me. And in fact, I felt deeply, deeply loved by my parents.
By 15, though, you decided you had enough. Your parents had split. You'd gone to your mother's an apartment of your mother's boyfriend, where you also just did not feel wanted. You left, started sleeping in stairwells, on the subway, at friends' houses during the day when their parents were out. Can you explain the title of your book, Breaking Night?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I found out later from other people that I was classified under homeless, right? I didn't think so. Here's what I thought. I was in the Bronx, or actually throughout urban America, we have this slang term for staying up all night until the sun rises, and that slang term is breaking night. So basically, if the sky is pitch black, the first hint of sun tells you that you've broken night. And so I would sleep at my friends' houses and go, oh, you know, I'm just breaking night. I'm staying up all night with my friends. I'm breaking night. In fact, I realized eventually that when I ran out of places to stay and found myself on the D train and in Central Park, I was actually homeless.
And what was that like, realizing that?
You know, it's really hard to put into words, but I would say just it felt like free falling, like realizing that, okay, you know how you have to call home, and if you don't call home, nobody worries. You know, people worry for you. They call it, where are you? You know, Jennifer's not home. For me, I remember a distinct feeling of sitting outside in the park, and I thought, how long would it take for somebody to realize I was gone and that I had sort of fell off the grid and been invisible, swallowed up into the ground, and the ground had shut over me, like my existence really didn't even matter.
You know, your story really could have taken such a different turn. I mean, we hear tragedies all the time. Was there a moment when you realized that you might be able to change this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had a wake-up call when my mother passed. She used to sit at the foot of my bed when I was a kid, and she'd share with me her dreams. She used to say, Lizzie, my family calls me Lizzie, Lizzie, one day I'll get sober. Lizzie, one day our lives will be better. One day. It was always about later and one day. And when she passed away and I buried her and I was 16 years old and sleeping outside, I remember thinking about how she said one day. And she had been homeless when she was my age in New York City. And when I buried her, the symmetry of her life and my life, our lives together, became clear. I was recreating a cycle, and something had to change.
So you did then. You changed. You enrolled at an alternative high school in New York. You had to go find your dad in a shelter to get him to sign the papers, right?
I did. Yeah.
You were still homeless while you were going to this high school. How did you manage that?
Well, that was my big secret. I didn't want anybody to know. I had had a not-so-great experience in foster care. I didn't want to be taken back. And I had to wake up every day either in my friends' houses or sometimes I'd sleep. There's this one staircase in the Bronx that was sort of a safe place. And I'd go to school day in and day out. And I had the best teachers at Humanities Preparatory Academy downtown in New York. They're wonderful. They surrounded me with support. And I guess more than anything, I just realized, okay, one day I had a home to live in and my family around me. The next day, I did not. And that taught me that life can change, that in one way, life is really a blank slate. Like, we get so invested in this is the way my life is, and I'm sure of it. But actually, every single day was a new chance. And I realized that I had the ability to carve out a life for myself, that it was in no way limited by what had already occurred in my past. And that inspired me to go to school.
And so you went to the alternative high school in New York. That led to a New York Times scholarship to college.
Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah, that was going to happen. That was a surprise.
Led to a lot of attention, floods of offers of help. What was that like?
You know, I grew up in a place where, I don't know, we sort of judged people in the Bronx. Anytime we saw somebody in a business suit or they looked successful, and I always thought it was sort of an us versus them, and I didn't really think, I don't know. I closed myself off so much. And then when I got the New York Times scholarship, when they wrote about my life story in the paper, I came to school, and there was all this mail, like mail from all these people all around the country, members of my community standing in the lobby of my school looking to meet me. They had things like baked brownies with them, clothing from their closets, gift packages for school. And I thought they wanted something back. You know, I was a little cynical at the time. I was in my gothic clothes, my homeless phase. But really, they were only there in service. And I just didn't know people could be good like that. I just didn't know people could be good in that way. And it's made me ever since want to be a better person.
Liz Murray is our guest. She's the author of Breaking Night. We're going to hear more of her story in a moment. We also want to hear from those of you who have also faced severe adversity. How do you overcome extreme obstacles? If you've faced homelessness, poverty, or neglect, tell us your story, 800-989-8255, or email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden. We're talking with Liz Murray. Her book is titled Breaking Night, a memoir of forgiveness, survival, and my journey from homeless to Harvard. As we've heard, she often faced tough decisions as a teenager about where to sleep, a rooftop or the subway, a public park or a friend's couch. You can read more about how Murray made it through those long nights in the Bronx in an excerpt at her website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We also want to hear your stories. If you've overcome extreme obstacles in your life, poverty, neglect, homelessness. How did you do it? The number is 800-989-8255 or email us at talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Liz Murray, you were just telling us how you had this outpouring of offers of help and attention when your story became public. Can you tell us, I just loved the story of the woman who offered to do your laundry.
She rocked. I love her. She showed up at my school. You know, I didn't know any of these folks, so you can imagine at the time being a little freaked out, 18 years old, people showing up at the lobby of my school or sending me letters. And I came out one day and she was outside on the sidewalk waiting for the time when school would dismiss. And there she was with her green station wagon minivan thing. And she said to me, Liz, shame on me. You know, she introduced herself, said, shame on me. I've had your news article up on my refrigerator for weeks, and I told myself I couldn't help you because, well, I don't have much money. But then today, sweetheart, I was doing my daughter's laundry, and it occurred to me, Liz must have some laundry. Doesn't everybody have some laundry? So she drove over the bridge from New Jersey, came over, opened up the door to her car and said, do you have some laundry? And she pointed in, and there were these plastic bins. She did my laundry once a week, every week, the entire last semester of school.
Wow.
She said, I can't do much, but I know I can do that.
That proves there's something everyone can do.
Right. I think what that comes from, right, because we're always sort of hit up for things, donate this, donate that. And I think we get cynical. We start, oh, I feed the homeless man, he's still homeless. I send $100 to Haiti, have I solved the whole problem? I think that's the wrong question, have I solved the whole problem? I think the question is just really, have I done my part? And that's what these folks taught me.
Let's bring a listener into the conversation. Blake is in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Blake.
Hi, Blake.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Well, first-time caller to any NPR show, although I listen all the time.
Thank you.
I wanted to say to Liz that I really identify with where she's coming from, because growing up, in rural Arkansas, I kind of had a problematic childhood. I was abused while I was 12 by family members, and by the time I reached high school, my mom's coke addiction had kind of taken over, and she kind of always put the men in her life before me or my brother or my three sisters. But I always felt that she loved me more than anything in the world, and I never stopped feeling that, and I still feel that to this day. We keep a very open relationship, and she's probably my biggest supporter. But by senior year of high school, I was living out of my 95 Lumina, and I had that secret as well that I was without a home. But being homeless kind of pushed me and focused my anger at the situation I was in into me getting a scholarship to WashU here in St. Louis. Number 11 school, Tyler Cornell, whatever that's worth. But, to get the chance to go to a top-tier school, I have to pay anything, and here I am sleeping in the back of a room, and it became my goal. I became solely focused on completing that goal.
Wow, that's...
So I graduate in May.
You graduate this coming May?
This coming May.
Congratulations. That's so amazing. What an amazing story.
Blake, what do you think gave you that motivation? I mean, what gave you that resilience, that motivation?
Well, my mom, first of all, honestly, single woman growing, raising five kids on her own, from my 18 years old down to my baby sister who was, only four. She's 14 years younger than me, and we span everywhere in between. So, seeing her every day do what she had to do to make sure that we went without, until it got really, really bad there at the end. There were some times when we have our lights shut off or we have to make a family trip to a food pantry. But, I never stopped feeling loved. And I never got the feeling from my mom that she was ever going to give up. She fought for whatever she had to keep all five of us together with her. And she's doing better now, too. She's got a... it's a little step down, four bedroom, two bathroom. She has an apartment now, and she has my brother and sisters with her now. So, it's kind of come full circle for everyone involved.
Blake, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Liz Murray, you have graduated Harvard, and you have now made it your profession, really, to inspire and motivate others.
Yeah.
Tell us about your work.
I mean, sorry, that was an amazing story with Blake. And, I love how he was able to take his mother's strength and make it his own. I think that's really beautiful.
Despite all the shortcomings.
Despite everything. Well, yeah, we're all human, right? And what ended up happening was, much to my surprise, there was all this attention after I went off to Harvard. And there was a movie made about all of this on Lifetime. There was just so much attention that got focused on my story. And what that created was an opportunity for me to share what were the tools, what were the strategies, what was the thinking that had me break through those boundaries. And as it grew and grew, I began speaking publicly all around the world with Washington Speakers Bureau. And from there, I developed my own seminars and workshops, Manifest Living. And those trainings are about people identifying what's not working in their life, what is working, what's not working, and what needs to change for me to get where I am, from where I am to where I want to go.
So just identifying it, first of all, figuring out what's wrong is one of the first steps?
I think a big piece of it is really the training. I do experiential trainings with people, and in some of my speeches I do experiential moments with people. And what I do with people is basically... what I'd learned with working with thousands of people traveling around the world for the last 10 years is it's just no matter what walk of life you come from, we have a lot in common. And one of the things we have in common is I think people believe that their circumstances are really who they are. We get so attached and identified to them, and we can begin to think that life is happening to us. And what I do in the workshops with people is I have them realize that there's actually so much more in your life that you have say-so over than you may realize. And I work with them around experiences for them to get that. And once you get that you have so much more control over your life, so much is possible. And my experiences work with people in order for them to get that distinction. And then I give them tools for empowerment to help change their lives.
Great. Let's take another call. Davita is in Denver, Colorado. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I really moved by your story. Like Jennifer, I want to be there so I can give you a hug because it's just wonderful how, I mean, to go to Harvard. I have a similar story. I grew up with a single mother who loved partying, and I had a younger brother, and, you know, we had times when, you know, we had to stay with people or, you know, and she'd party and do drugs, and just times when I just watching her do drugs. But the thing that struck me, what you said, is that your parents loved you, and I knew my mother loved me. And when I was a kid, I thought my mother was the best mother, and I loved her. And I can still remember a poem that I wrote to honor her. You know, of course, now as an adult, I realize, wow, maybe she wasn't the best mother, but I just knew that she loved me, and you know, that love inspired me. But people take it in different ways. My brother, you know, he has used it as a crutch and, you know, as a reason to, you know, for his failures, whereas I've kind of used it to, you know, it's made me stronger, and I put myself through college, and, you know, I feel like I'm somewhat successful in my life.
Oh, well, Davida, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in, Davida.
Liz, what makes the difference there? Between someone who, you know, uses it as a crutch, like Davida said.
I mean, it's so much of life is interpretation, really. I mean, it's made up. You know, how we feel about what's possible for us from moment to moment to moment has so much to do with interpretation. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of reasons in life that people come to disempowered interpretations. I mean, we could talk about them forever, you know, statistics and violence and poverty and all kinds of things. But really, I think what I'm more interested in is working with people and looking at what gets people to a place where they can be empowered and realize that if their life is up to their own interpretation, well, then they can shift it at any time. Every single moment is another chance to do something differently. You know, and I think sometimes that takes mentorship, experience, supportive circles around you. I don't believe people get where they're going alone. So I do believe that surrounding you with support, community, mentorship, that kind of thing is needed. But ultimately, really centering around the idea that nothing that you do in this next moment has to be based on your past.
Let's take another call. Anne is in South Bend, Indiana. Hi, Anne.
Hello, everybody. And Liz, I have to start off by saying, darling, you are a highly educated, well-spoken, tough broad.
Okay. Thank you, miss.
You're very welcome, darling.
I don't think I've ever been called a tough broad, but
well,
I love it.
I don't know any other word for it because that's what it takes to get where you got. I was raised by a well-thought-of family in the neighborhood. My father was a professional musician at a highly regarded, I won't go into that. My mother was a blaring, blithering alcoholic from the day I was born. She sexually abused me and tortured me until I was 10 and then introduced me to alcohol. She then decided that her alcoholism was much more important than doing anything else with me, and I crippled my way into private schools, which I was always sent to, but I would wet my pants at 10 and 11 and 12. I was afraid of people, and then I got into the Woodstock era to jump a little bit. And, of course, we hang around with the dealers, and we hung around at apartments, empty apartments. And then several times we just set up, and if we were firing up, token up, whatever the heck we were doing, some young guy would walk in and fire up in front of us, and he'd drop dead, and we'd just blow the candle out and walk over his body and go on. What stopped me was I could no longer find a high. I mellowed to a point and got high so often, there was no place to go. So I would hang around in alleys looking for somebody to love me. Praise God I never got pregnant, okay? I'll just end it that way. But one day, my brother, who was 15 years older than me, not knowing the insanity that was going on in my mother and my life, found me and said, "You are either crazy or you're an alcoholic." And I said, both. He He happened to have had 25 years of sobriety at the time and was the director of a treatment program in Illinois that I didn't know about. And he said, I'll get you a free bed at Hazleton if you want it, and turned around and walked out of the alley. And I took a drink. I went to Hazleton. For the next 40 years, darling, I have set up treatment programs.
And well, thank you so much for sharing that story. And I need to pause now to tell people you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another phone call. Gloria is in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Gloria.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
My story is more, I'm a parent, and I'm homeless, and so is my son. And my worry for him is that he has taken this situation and used and not been able to take a more positive approach to all the things he sees happening to me.
So you want to motivate him to seek something better?
Yes.
So, Liz, what would you suggest to Gloria?
I think getting him in a supportive environment that can meet his needs. And first of all, my heart goes out to you, you know, when you share your situation. And I can only imagine how disheartening it is to see him, you know, going in a bad direction. But I think, well, first thing, actually, I would say unconditional love, because we're talking a parent-child dynamic here.
Yeah.
Unconditional love. Unconditional love and support, that you are always there for him no matter what he does. You love him. I think that's a bedrock in that relationship. But also, I think there are so many different needs that we have in that situation. I believe what saves people is to send them to a program, a school, a supportive environment where they can be surrounded by other young people in situations like their own and that are also working towards empowerment. I would look for a really great program, a really great school, and surround him with resources, because no single person can be the source of everything.
Yes.
And, you know, of course, coming from you, it's going to be different than if he were surrounded by peers who are going through the same. I would find a program to connect him with where you are.
Okay. How do I do that? How do I find that program?
You know, did you say you're in Buffalo, New York?
Yes.
You know, I wonder if we could be put in touch after the radio show.
Sure.
I can call some people and see if I can find any programs up there.
Gloria, I'm going to put you on hold, all right? And we'll make sure we know how to contact you afterwards.
Thank you, Gloria,
so much for calling.
Thank-
and Tina is in San Antonio, Texas.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi. I want to say thank you for taking my call, and thank you for being on the air and sharing this story. I like all the other callers, have a similar story of family abuse and drug abuse in my childhood. But I think that as a mother, I have four children of my own, and I've turned my life around and a college degree. I think the most important thing when I look around me is to notice, sadly, a lot of people have not been able to find a way to change and don't see that there is a need to change. And I'm just grateful for every little person standing at a random place who said something positive to me, who said, you can change that cycle, you can change your life, or you're really intelligent. Even though I wasn't intelligent, I was a high school dropout. You know, I think that's so important, because a lot of people don't get that.
I think also you can be a high school dropout and be very intelligent, you know, and you have all this great stuff going on inside of you, but you disconnect from school. And I think when people do that, sometimes they don't see how school applies to their lives. You know, like you go and let's say you have nothing to eat, your fridge is empty, your parents are fighting, your house is a mess, and then you go to school and someone's giving you a social studies lesson. It just doesn't, you can't see how to bridge the two worlds. And that's why I can't stress enough the importance of, you know, if you can get kids to programs and education where you can enrich their understanding of how they actually do have a place in society. Why, if they get an education, what's possible for them? I absolutely can't stress it enough, because a lot of the kids I met that were dropouts were brilliant. They just couldn't get themselves to sit in the chair and go to school.
All right. Well, Tina, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
And Liz Marie, up next, very briefly, you're going to grad school, I understand, or applying for grad school.
I'm applying for grad school. Yes, I am.
Well, good luck with that. Liz Murray's book is titled Breaking Night. And again, we've posted an excerpt at our website, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Liz Marie, thank you so much.
Jennifer, thank you so much for having me on.
Up next, we'll get into the furor over one Florida pastor's plan to burn the Koran this weekend. What do you have to say about it? 800-989-8255 or email us talk@npr.org. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.